Let me make an obvious observation, and that is there seems to be rather more of you here to this event of the Hellenic Observatory than we normally get in our weekly seminars. Instead of perhaps 30 or 40 guests, we seem to have a few more this afternoon, and we're very pleased about that. Of course, the size of the audience, the event this afternoon, is a reflection of the topicality of today's theme. We're taking the opportunity of the current Greek presidency of the European Union to relate today's topic to our interests as the Hellenic Observatory. Of course, the Council presidency, the Greek Council presidency of the European Union, places the Greek government and our guests this afternoon at the center of European and indeed transatlantic diplomacy in the context of the current crisis. Now, the observant members of the audience will have noticed that on stage is not Javier Solana, the secretary, the high representative for CFSP of the European Union. Unfortunately, he has had to withdraw at the last moment, and he sends his apologies. We can assume that it must have been something important which has prevented him from attending this afternoon, as we had repeated assurances until very late that he was committed to being here for this afternoon's debate. Obviously, in the context of the current crisis, events are rather fluid and unpredictable. However, as you may have noticed from the screen behind me, we do indeed have a replacement speaker. We're very fortunate in welcoming Paul Beaver, who will join us as soon as he's got through the London traffic. No mean feat. He will join us on stage shortly. But Paul is a well-known defense analyst based here in London. He is a former editor of Jane's Defense Weekly, and he has been a consultant on security matters for a number of governments. You may recognize him as a TV pundit on defense and security matters, and he is well able to speak about the current preparations for intervention in Iraq. This afternoon's debates is followed by a session this evening at 6 o'clock. You may have seen from the programs which have been distributed, or again possibly from the screen behind me at an earlier stage, that at 6 o'clock we have a further discussion which is based on a number of prominent speakers, academics and journalists, to take up some of the themes which have been developed this afternoon. We have at 6 o'clock Roger Boys of the Times, Professor Fotouris of the University of Athens, Professor Sir Lawrence Friedman of King's College London, Quentin Peel of the Financial Times, and Professor Paul Taylor of the European Institute here at the LSE. And that discussion is this evening at 6 o'clock in D202. No tickets are required, but seating will be on a first-come, first-served basis. Let me give one final plug, and that is that this Friday evening we also have an additional event, which is a public lecture by Mr. Christos Protopapas, the Greek Minister of Press and Information, and he will be speaking about the Greek presidency of the European Union. The lecture will take place at 6:30 this Friday in D602, and the lecture will be in Greek. But to come back today, both of today's sessions are organized jointly, equally, by the Hellenic Observatory and the Institute for Defense Analysis in Athens. The events this afternoon are therefore part of our continuing collaboration between the two institutions, and we look forward to that collaboration developing in the future. As you can appreciate, an event like this takes a lot of time and effort to organize. And I'd just like to very briefly thank those people who have helped this to become possible. I thank our colleagues in the Institute in Athens, my colleagues here at the LSC, the offices for conferences and events, and the press office. I'd like to thank my colleague Maurice Fraser for making the participation of Paul Beaver possible, I hope. And I'd like to thank our team in the Hellenic Observatory, and in particular our secretary Katerina Lakopoulou for her unfailing support and efficient service. But of course, for some weeks now, the focus of our public debate has been European security and Iraq. Every day we seem to see new twists and turns in the complex international diplomacy surrounding the crisis. Will Washington and London wait for a second UN resolution? Will France and Russia veto a second resolution? And what of Europe? Who speaks for Europe in the present crisis? More fundamentally, perhaps, what credibility will European cooperation in foreign policy and in security matters have after this crisis is over? What are the long-term consequences of what we're currently engaged in? Well, our speakers this afternoon are very well placed to guide us through the major issues confronting European security and to look indeed beyond the current crisis. Mr. Yanis Papandreou is currently Minister of National Defence in Athens, and as such, of course, is closely engaged in the discussions within the European Union on cooperation in foreign policy and the development of a European voice in security matters. Dr. Papandreou has been Defence Minister since October 2001. Before that, he served as Minister of National Economy and Finance for about 7 years, and as such, it was perhaps his major political achievement to take Greece into the euro, the single European currency, and in doing so, he gained enormous respect at both home and abroad. Dr. Papandreou is now an established ally of the London School of Economics, if I may say. He has spoken here on two previous occasions, and we look forward very much to his comments this afternoon. To his left on the platform, we have Alessandro Minito Rizzo, recently appointed as Deputy Secretary General of NATO. Mr. Rizzo has had a long and varied diplomatic career. On behalf of Italy, he has served in Washington, Paris, and Prague. He has been coordinator for EU affairs in the Foreign Ministry in Rome and diplomatic counselor of the Minister of Defense. Before moving to NATO, Mr. Rizzo was Italian ambassador to the European Union with special interest in security matters. He thus brings a perspective that can combine his experience in both the European Union and NATO. So, can we please give a very warm welcome to our speakers this afternoon? Let me just add a couple of small points. After the presentations of each speaker, and we'll in a moment, I'll invite Dr. Papandreou to speak to us, followed by Mr. Rizzo, and then followed by Paul Beaver. After we've had each speaker's presentation, there will, of course, be time for questions and comments from the audience, brief questions and comments from the audience. So we appreciate the topic of this afternoon is, of course, controversial. Hopefully it's controversial. And we simply ask you to keep your comments and questions until after the speakers have made their presentation. And we're scheduled to finish 3:30, 3:45, thereabouts. A couple of other small points to note. Our official guests this afternoon have been invited to a reception which will begin at 4 o'clock in the senior common room in the old building. And we look forward to welcoming you there. But I guess without any further words from me, I simply invite Dr. Papandreou to speak to us this afternoon, and we look forward to your presentation. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me first thank very much Dr. Mr. Featherstone and his and Dr. Featherstone, Professor Featherstone, to name all his attributes, for organizing this very substantial and impressive event, for projecting the work done by the Greek presidency in defense matters relating to European defense. European defense is a very topical issue nowadays for many reasons, relating both to the crisis of Iraq and generally with the course of the European Union, especially as regards the European Constitution and its further work and steps towards political unification. So I regard this as an especially interesting event, which will give the possibility both to us and to you to express views as to the future course of European defense, and also to express sentiments about the likely evolution of events regarding the crisis of Iraq, which here in Britain, as well as in Greece, as well as in the rest of the world, remains an exceptionally important subject. A subject which may, in the way it evolves, determine the course of global politics for some years to come. Ladies and gentlemen, at the end of the Cold War, it was widely felt by many people that the world would enter a period of relative calm as related to the tensions that had been seen and lived during the Cold War. In the Cold War, there were many periods of tension which related to the nuclear threats and the fact that there were two superpowers, the United States of America and the Soviet Union, which were exchanging threats and were engaged in fairly aggressive behavior. However, we're gradually realizing that the uncertainties currently characterizing international relations are fraught with greater dangers than those dangers that did exist during the time of East-West confrontation. At that time, the West was facing a known enemy with a responsible government with whom we could argue, with could negotiate, and eventually come to an agreement. Now the enemy is unknown. There are some shadowy groups we don't precisely know, or some totally irresponsible governments or states called the rogue states, which have a behavior which is totally irresponsible and unpredicted. This entails dangers which are of a far greater nature, but graver nature than the dangers we lived in the previous period. This changed international environment has given rise to some new thinking regarding global security. Two distinct trends have appeared. The first promotes multilateral coalition building in the belief that such dangers are best dealt with on this basis. Single states alone cannot deal with these dangers because threats such as terrorism are internationalized threats and must be faced through multilateral coalitions. Another trend, however, is emerging, which is lacking a multinational coalition, a state is entitled to engage in a preemptive war, in a preemptive strike to disarm the enemy. These are two conflicting trends, and the evolution and outcome of the present Iraq crisis will probably determine which trend will prevail in the coming years ahead. There is, however, a common element in both these trends, that isolationism is no longer an option, that dangers are international, and only through international efforts they can be dealt with. In the midst of this very fluid international situation, the European Union has a special opportunity to reassert itself and exert a higher and stronger influence on the course of world events. In the context of the common foreign and security policy, the European Union has played an active role, particularly in relation to the management of crises in the Balkans and the Middle East. The events of September 11th have intensified further cooperation among us, among member states of the European Union, and given rise to the European Security and Defense Policy, to the so-called ESDP. What is the objective of the ESDP? The main objective of the ESDP is to create a force of up to 60,000 people designed to engage in the so-called Petersburg task. Petersburg is the name of a town in Europe which where the conference was held to create the ESTP. And what are these tasks? These tasks are mainly peaceful tasks. It's providing humanitarian assistance and also providing peacekeeping and peacemaking. That is, after the war has ended, then this European Rapid Reaction Force enters the scene and establishes peace, keeps peace, makes peace, and provides humanitarian assistance to those who have been victims of the war. It is what we're doing in Bosnia, what we're doing in Kosovo, what we are likely to do in Skopje, in Fyrom, in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, where the ESTP will soon go in early April to preserve peace and keep peace and make peace if necessary. What is the role of Greece in all this? Greece holds since July 1st the presidency, July 1st of 2002, the presidency of the ESTP, on account of the fact that during the last semester when Denmark had the presidency, Denmark had opted out from defense matters and Greece was kindly asked by Denmark to assume this role. So Greece exerts the presidency for 12 months, which is an unusually long period, which I'm afraid is a motivation to produce real results. There is no alibi for not producing results during 12 months. So now we're in the end, essentially, of this period, in which our main task was to make the ESTP happen, to make the European Rapid Reaction Force work. In pursuing this objective, we faced two obstacles. The first of obstacles was of a more technical and defense-related nature, I would say. It related to the fact that many governments in Europe were either unwilling or not in a position to provide to the European Rapid Reaction Force the weapon systems, the military capabilities which were necessary. There were many delays which related both to unwillingness and also to incapacity to do so as a result of the fact that European governments and states spend little on defense. They don't have enough weapons themselves, so they didn't have enough weapons to provide to the European Rapid Reaction Force. But also it was partly unwillingness, to the extent that some governments preferred to keep the weapons for themselves instead of providing them for a common collective force of defense, such as the European Rapid Reaction Force. So Greece has as its first objective the task to speed up this process of filling the shortfalls in European capabilities, and we did so in two successful, I would say, sessions of the European Council of Defense Ministers in Rethymnon, Crete and Brussels last semester, in which we committed ourselves to hold a conference in May of this year, 2003, in which all governments will provide to the European Rapid Reaction Force the capabilities, the weapon systems that are missing for it to become fully operational. So this is an important step which has already been achieved. By the middle of this year, we shall be able to say that the European Rapid Reaction Force is operationally ready to intervene. The second obstacle was of a more political nature. It was the absence of an agreement between NATO and the European Union on how to cooperate in defense matters. This is essential because the European Defense Force lacks the total range of capabilities which are necessary for it to work, while NATO possesses these capabilities. So it is important for the European Union to be able to rely on assets and capabilities of NATO when it engages in operations or enterprises or even exercises. But the consultations between the two organizations did not mark sufficient progress. They lasted for about 18 months, and there were problems in these consultations because somehow NATO countries wanted to impose on the European Union, on the European Rapid Reaction Force, a position which tended to look a bit inferior in relation to NATO. NATO wanted to have a say in the way the European Rapid Reaction Force engages in operations, even when the EU did not rely on NATO assets or capabilities. So there was a lack of equivalence, if you say, of equality between the two organizations. That was the reason why we had a new round of talks between NATO and the EU, and we finally came to an agreement in Copenhagen, in the last European Council meeting in Copenhagen in December of last year, in which we agreed on a text which fully establishes the equivalence of the two organizations and also their complementarity. The idea being that both NATO and the EU serve approximately the same purposes and the same values. We should work together, but on an equal footing between the EU and NATO. The aim is to complete a transatlantic pact between NATO and the EU that would recognize the existence of an autonomous European Union defense agenda, but which will not compete with, but complement NATO. The first operation of the ASTP, as I indicated before, will be in Fyrom, in the former Yugoslav Republic of Yugoslavia, in April of this year, in which a contingent of about 600 persons comprising the European Rapid Reaction Force will go there to replace the existing international mission that is controlled by NATO. So the European Union, in this sense, it will replace NATO, it will perform functions which are performed by NATO, working with NATO, but also preserving for the European Union the capacity to act by itself if it does not rely on NATO assistance, on NATO assets, and NATO infrastructures and capabilities. Now, this opens a whole range of questions regarding the evolution of the relation between NATO and the EU. What is the role of NATO? What is the role of the EU? NATO and the EU, first of all, share the same basic values. And what are these values? Respect for democracy, human rights, the rule of law, security and stability throughout the world. And we Europeans have an obvious responsibility to uphold these values in cooperation with NATO. And that was the reason why NATO and the Americans supported, and still support to some extent, the creation of the European Rapid Reaction Force. They support it because they don't want to assume the whole burden of global peace and security upon themselves. They want Europe to share some of the burden. And that is why even Europe, also Europe wants to create its force, because we believe that to face threats such as terrorism or such other global threats, this is not only the responsibility of the Americans, it is also the responsibility of us Europeans who have to assume some of the burdens. So we create our own force that will work not in competition, but in a complementary way with the United States of America and with NATO. At the same time, NATO has evolved. NATO was created in the early 50s to face a distinct territorial threat. And the territorial threat was that presented by the Soviet Union and the countries belonging to the Soviet bloc. But then the bloc dissolved, the Soviet Union was dissolved, broke down, and from the last decade to now, NATO has gradually evolved from an organization which is created to defend territory to an organization which is created to defend values and global interests. So the weapons of NATO, the purpose of NATO, the structure of NATO, the behavior of NATO is changing. You don't need any more tanks or frigates or submarines or even fighter aircraft. You need other more sophisticated weapons in order to face global security threats such as terrorism or such as the instability which is created by regimes that break down, such as the Yugoslav regime in the late 90s. So NATO becomes a different thing, a different type of military organization than one we used to have. Terrorism is a threat faced by NATO, but also it is a threat faced by the European Union. Terrorism is a global threat. And it is quite evident that all European countries and all European governments are committed to fight terrorism. And in particular, we're fully unified in the fight to ensure the disarmament of Iraq from weapons of mass destruction. The priority of our presidency is to work for the peaceful settlement of conflicts, most prominently the Iraq crisis, within the context of international law, which provides for the United Nations as the appropriate framework for dealing with such issues. One might say, why were not the United Nations involved in other wars? There is a big difference. Other wars take place because the country that undertakes or engages in war is aggressed by some country. And of course, it responds without having a recourse to the United Nations. The situation is different with Iraq. Now, what about some countries are about to strike Iraq in the context of a preventive war? It's a preemptive strike. So it is important for such war, which could be labeled an aggressive war, in quotes, that this decision has a stamp of international legality. Because if there is no international legality, if this decision is taken unilaterally, it may create an extremely dangerous precedent. Because in the future, some other country with perhaps less benign intentions could rely on what happened, is happening now, and engage in a purely aggressive war, pretending that this war is a preventive war to avoid future conflict or future aggressions. So this is dangerous, and so we must avoid setting this precedent, and this is why Europe and the European and the Greek presidency insist on maintaining our insistence on following the process of the United Nations and the United Nations Security Council in particular. So we therefore hope to see the United Nations efforts bear positive results. The European Union aims at the full disarmament of Iraq from weapons of mass destruction, supporting every possibility to ensure a peaceful resolution of this crisis. And in particular, we support the work of the United Nations inspectors. Greece is making every effort to bring its partners to a common position, however difficult it is, especially speaking here in London. However, if Europe wishes to exert a significant influence on the course of world affairs, it must speak and act in unison. If we act and speak separately, then our influence is diminished very dramatically. To this end, in order to be able to forge a common position, the Greek presidency has called an extraordinary European summit on February 17 in Brussels. Many people thought that it would be impossible for 15 leaders, including President Chirac and Mr. Blair, would arrive at a common text. In fact, they did. Some people may say that the text didn't go far enough. It is quite obvious. But still, the repetition of some basic facts, basic principles, was important. One such principle was that the war is only a measure of the last resort. A second is that we should continue to insist on the United Nations process. This is something that unites all European nations. And thirdly, it was a clear message to Saddam Hussein to cooperate actively with the inspectors so as to implement all United Nations resolutions, including Resolution 1441, demanding the full and immediate disarmament from weapons of mass destruction. So the Brussels text, despite its limitations, had a wider significance. And the significance was that despite all the differences, Europe still wanted and wants to speak with one voice. Of course, this is not the end of the struggle for European cohesion. In these stages and the next few weeks, European cohesion will be further tested. And depending on the outcome of this process, which will test European cohesion, and then we may discuss it later, this will determine the future course of European political and defense unification. If Europe stays somehow united in this crisis, of course, the field is open to further intensify the efforts for European unification. If, however, Europe breaks up, with one country imposing a veto on a draft resolution proposed by another country of the European Union, then, of course, many scenarios are open for the future evolution of the European Union as a cohesive political group acting in unison in world affairs. But we may come to this later. Ultimately, after the crisis is over, the question, as I said, will arise as to whether the European Union has the will and the power to exercise a distinct influence on world affairs corresponding to its economic weight and most important to its history. With our unprecedented expansion to the East and West and the perspective of admitting still new members in the future, we're building on Europe as a unified continent. But this continent goes beyond geography. It unites us by mutual interests and shared values. These values are connected with freedom, with prosperity, with a European distinct conception of social justice, which differentiates us from the United States, as well as the transparency of our democracies, acting in the framework of international legality, which is another distinguishing feature from the United States of America. Consolidating and sustaining these values is among our priorities, and strengthening the European security and defense policy within the wider context of political unification responds to this challenge. The question arises, what do we mean by strengthening the European security and defense policy? It means essentially three things. The first question concerns the strength and the scope of the European Rapid Reaction Force. How important and sizable is likely to be or must be the European Army? That's the first question. We now have 60,000 people assigned to the tasks of humanitarian assistance and peacemaking. Do we want to enlarge this, to make it stronger, to give them new tasks? That's one question. The second question is, how much, what is the extent of mutual assistance among European Union members on defense matters? For instance, if a country receives a threat from a different country or from a terrorist organization, to what extent the other European Union countries will act to assist this country, the threatened country, for facing this threat? Shall we introduce an Article 5, according to the NATO organization, within the European Union Charter and Constitution or not? Shall we bind ourselves together in assisting ourselves against aggressors, be they states or international organizations, terrorist organizations? That is the second question that must be answered. And then a third question concerns the link between European defense and European industry. We do have an economy. We do have our own industrial base. If we wish really to develop a defense force which is capable of intervening effectively in matters affecting world peace and security, then we have to equip this force with sufficient military capabilities. And therefore, our own industrial base must develop in the way of equipping this force with the necessary capabilities. Also, providing jobs and technology to the wider European economy, because the defense industries form a substantial part of this wider European economy. Now, on the first two questions, strength and scope of the European Rapid Reaction Force and the extent of the mutual assistance arrangements, these two questions are addressed by the Convention for the Future European Constitution. Now, in this convention, in which British, Greeks, and all others are represented under the chairmanship of Monsieur Giscard d'Estaing, the former French president, they construct, they draft a European constitution which will address these questions. How far should the European security and defense policy go? How strong should be the European army? How much mutual assistance shall we have? And in fact, a substantial part of that convention is in favor of strengthening the European security and defense policy, and Greece is among those nations who favor this development. Of course, the ultimate answer will be given by the intergovernmental conference, not the convention. The convention will provide a draft, but then the governments will decide on the actual constitution. And of course, we shall see in a year's time how far Europe is willing to go in the road of political unification and defense strengthening. On the other question, on the link between defense and industry, the Greek presidency is undertaking an important initiative which will be decided this month in the European Council, in which we have two aims. The first is to increase the funds going to research which relates to defense, such as space research and other research which is important to strengthen and intensify the effort for increasing the competitiveness of European defense industries. And the second is to create a European armaments organization agency, which will create a better climate, a better market, so to speak, for weapon systems in Europe, in which we shall favor the development of European industry and defense. But these are important questions which will charter the course of Europe in the next few years. Defense, of course, goes together with a common foreign policy. And common foreign policy goes together with whether Europe will develop into a federal political organization? Will Europe have a president? Will it have something resembling a government? Will it have a common foreign minister representing for a broad range of subjects all European countries? And this common foreign policy will have the backing of a strong defense force? These are exceptionally important questions that will determine the course of European unification after the completion of the economic and monetary union. These are questions for which the first answers will be given in the convention for the European Constitution, and then the next year in 2004 by the Intergovernmental Conference. Then we shall see the type of questions we shall get, and of course each country will determine its own course within this new setup. But of course the outcome of the Iraq crisis will create a framework in which these questions will be faced. If, for instance, the Iraq crisis evolves in a way in which European Union is not broken, then this will create a positive precedent for advancing European Union for the entire European Union of the 25 countries. This may encourage the Convention and the Intergovernmental Conference to proceed along the lines set for European unification, for Europe, European Union as a whole. If, on the other hand, another scenario is envisaged, in which European Union, European unity breaks down in a month or two, if one country vetoes another country, if war takes place in Iraq by unilateral kind of pronouncement without the backing of the international of the United Nations, if there is this kind of rift between Europe and America, then other scenarios may develop. Then perhaps one group of countries, including France definitely, may opt to proceed along the road of European political and defense unifications, leaving others on the side, in much the same way as the Economic and Monetary Union proceeded with some countries and other countries having the option of joining later. This is something that is done in Europe. It is the principle of variable geometry or of optional cooperative arrangements. And this, of course, is something which is fraught with dangers, because if a group of European countries proceed to create a political and defense Europe without the others, then this may open a wider, even wider rift between Europe and the United States of America. And this may create more global problems for world stability and world peace. So these are very important questions, which I mention not to resolve them here, but simply to indicate the importance of the outcome of the Iraq crisis for the future of European defense. It very much depends on how this crisis evolves, on how it sort of, what sort of political messages it produces, because these messages will be heard very loudly and clearly by European nations and governments when they set their course for European unification in the convention and later in the conference. So far as we are concerned, and so far as Greece is concerned, our idea is clear, and I'm afraid not so simple. Our idea is that America and Europe share a number of basic values. But within this set of basic values, Europe has a distinct set of values and priorities which should be projected by a more coherent European political foreign policy and common defense. And therefore, Greece is in favor of creating a more autonomous and coherent European political defense organization, however, retaining the transatlantic relationship and the link with the United States. We don't know, as of the present time, whether this project is feasible. It very much depends on the outcome of the Iraqi crisis and the political climate that will prevail between Europe and America in the next months and years. But we do hope that a way is found to establish this course, which will allow both for Europe to assert its values and priorities in the modern, complicated, and turbulent world, while preserving the strategic partnership with the United States of America. It is an ambitious project, but it is a project, I think, that corresponds better and more efficiently to the needs of the European Union, both on the economics, on politics, and defense. Now, regarding the outcome, the events about Iraq, and I close with this, of course, it is not here the time to pronounce forecasts. My idea is that there are strong forces leading to the war option. There's no question about this. But I would also like to stress that there still remains a window for diplomacy on account of the fact that if the war option is taken without a proper backing by the international community, this war option is fraught with grave dangers concerning both the stability of the Middle East, especially on the Palestinian side, and also the stability of other parts of the world. It is very dangerous to go for war without having the backing of world public opinion. After all, we are democracies, and in democracies, the people and people's views always must prevail. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister. I know some of you need to go for 3 o'clock lectures. The life of the LSE continues, whatever the conference schedule. Can I welcome to the platform Paul Beaver, who has now joined us and managed to achieve what most people struggle with, and that is to get through the traffic in London. Whilst Paul is taking his seat, can I welcome Minito Rizzo and ask him to make his presentation for the conference. Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to give you a view of the STP from a different angle, for an important one, I think, which is the one of the NATO-EU relations as a contribution from my side to today's discussion. A few years ago, a presentation on NATO-EU relations could have been given the title of a famous science fiction novel, When Worlds Collide. Although the two organizations are located in the same city, they might as well have been on different planets. Even diplomats living in Brussels in the past usually never saw each other very much. In fact, up until a couple of years ago, the only professional contact allowed between the two organizations at any level was a monthly breakfast meeting between the NATO Secretary General and the EU High Representative. And even that had to be called informal breakfast. This era of benign neglect is over. And today, NATO and EU enjoy a level of cooperation that would recently have been inconceivable. And the reason is very simple indeed. We have no more time to waste. During the Cold War, NATO and European integration process complemented each other perfectly. As NATO provided security for its members and thus provided an umbrella for European development. On the other side, the European community could focus on economic and political integration. That division of labor made sense at that time. After all, since Western Europe was facing a powerful adversary, a credible defense could only be provided by a transatlantic framework. Let it be NATO. In the post-Cold War, however, that imbalance suddenly began to bite. Over Bosnia, the lack of a common European political position undermined a coherent Western approach to this issue and created resentment in Washington. Over Kosovo, the lack of effective European military capabilities caused problems on both sides of the Atlantic. with the Americans complaining about burden sharing and European complaining about impotence. Bosnia and then Kosovo made it clear that the transatlantic imbalance was no longer sustainable for reasons of military effectiveness and politically equitable burden sharing. Europe had to play a stronger security role, including through its most integrated entity, the European Union. That realization led directly to the British-French summit in Saint-Malo at the end of 1998, as you may know, some of you, which opened up the possibility of a real European security and defense policy within the European Union with effective military tools, thus creating a new ambition. An SDP that is now beginning to rectify the deficiencies that have plagued both NATO and EU for years, which is to say asymmetry in the military capabilities between the United States and Europe, and the lack of an effective and workable European crisis management role in cases where NATO as a whole was not engaged. At the EU Helsinki summit, December 1999, ambitious goals were set. First, going beyond purely institutional measures, the EU set itself an ambitious headline goal of creating by 2003 the means to deploy 60,000 troops within 60 days sustainable in theater for at least 1 year, unquote. The EU has also identified the forces and capabilities its members have to commit in order to meet their collective headline goal. Another decision was to establish a political and security committee to provide advice to European Union leaders on security issues, as well as today political leadership of European operations. And I was myself a founding member of this endeavor in its first year of activity. And thirdly, the EU members decided on the creation of a military committee and a military staff to provide advice to the political and security committee and to carry out their directions during potential operations. The next challenge for the EU was translating these ambitious goals into practice. Making ESDP a reality means that the level of political ambition must be matched by adequate capabilities. And here I think we have to pay tribute to the important efforts of the Greek presidency during this year. And it's also here where NATO comes into play, because only through close cooperation with NATO can such a European option be developed successfully. Why? Because NATO has a vast experience in security matters, as Mr. Papantonio just said a few moments ago, in peacekeeping, in defense diplomacy, as a framework for wider security cooperation, and of course, as a framework of a collective defense. It also has a well-functioning command structure and has unique planning capabilities. From this perspective, close cooperation between NATO and the European Union is not just desirable, it is essential. But there is more. 11 countries are currently members of both organizations. But as of next year, NATO and EU will consist of 26 and 25 members respectively. And the number of countries that will be members in both organizations will grow to the number of 19. Due to the significant overlap in membership between the two organizations, complementarity and mutual reinforcement in the EU and NATO defense structures is absolutely necessary. After all, each country has only one budget and only one set of forces. Therefore, close links between the European Union and NATO are indispensable in order to avoid unnecessary duplication. And this is well recognized in Europe and the United States. And there is yet a third reason why NATO and the European Union need to work closely together. And this reason is 9/11 and its implications. In the struggle against terrorism, NATO and the EU have both been using the different means at their disposal, from invoking Article 5 to freezing suspicious bank accounts. Together, however, they can bring their collective expertise to bear, for example, in areas such as civil emergency planning or consequence management. For all these reasons, we have moved quickly to turn the fury of NATO-EU relations into practice. In fact, you may say that practice moved ahead of fury, because we moved ahead with practical cooperation before we had the institutional diagrams. 2 years ago, when a crisis erupted in southern Serbia, NATO and the European Union consulted closely on developing a common political approach, already a first, and one that delivered results. Shortly thereafter, when the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia was on the brink of a civil war in the year 2001, NATO and the European Union again engaged in the search for a political solution, but this time backed by a robust military commitment. It worked. European Union observers supported by NATO forces have helped in a decisive way to defuse the crisis. A small force will remain in the country until the end of this year to help maintain its growing stability. What matters is a job well done, and NATO and the European Union are determined to make this happen. Clearly, our practical cooperation has developed very well, but until very recently, the institutional side of the relationship lagged behind. It was only last December, 3 months ago, that the European Union's Copenhagen Council, followed by a decision of the NATO Council, finally brought about a truly historic breakthrough, an agreement on the modalities of NATO-EU cooperation. Since last December, NATO has made major progress on the whole range of issues that affect NATO-EU relations. For example, NATO has agreed on the practicalities of how we would provide assured European Union access to NATO operational planning, which is a very important tool for any military operation. The role of Deputy Secure, NATO's Deputy Strategic Commander, as strategic coordinator between NATO and the European Union has been agreed, as well as the broader elements of how the alliance could provide command arrangements to the European Union, if so requested. We have developed a list of presumably available pre-identified NATO capabilities for potential use by the European Union. A NATO-European Union permanent security agreement has been developed for the exchange of sensitive information between the two organizations, and it will be signed the day after tomorrow in Brussels by the NATO Secretary General and the Greek presidency of the European Union. In short, the essential elements of NATO-EU permanent relations are falling into place. And I have with me, but I'm not going to bore you with that, a list of about 15 documents who have been established in the past 2 months going in that direction. Now, following a NAC decision, this will allow the possibility for the European Union taking over the current NATO military operation in Fyrom in the very near future. Preparations for this handover are well underway. Deputy Secure would be the strategic commander in his European role, not NATO role. European Union military personnel are now working out of NATO strategic headquarters in Mons. Lines of communication, logistical chains, and reinforcement relationships are being developed for the EU force to work with the support of NATO forces. The essence of this relationship is clear. For the European Union, it offers a first military mission in full cooperation with the alliance. For NATO, it offers a true and trusted security partner. For Euro-Atlantic security, it offers a more substantial transatlantic balance of burdens and responsibilities. Clearly, a successful handover in Fyrom, Macedonia, would in itself be a major step forward for European security and defense policy. But there are more challenges to this project. And in closing, let me mention just one: creating sufficient military capabilities. Let there be no mistake, the seriousness of ESDP will not be judged by the amount of rhetoric Europeans can muster to extol the virtues of this project. The true litmus test for ESDP will be whether it strengthens European military muscle. With the headline goal, Europe has set itself a realistic, achievable target, but it is still ambitious. To meet it, significant improvement will have to be made to Europe's military capability in a range of areas from training to recruitment to procurement. To some extent, these challenges can be met by getting a better return of investment, innovative management techniques, identification of priorities, professionalization, downsizing, transnational cooperation. That is why we must make sure that NATO Capabilities Initiative and the European Union Capabilities Action Plan are complementary and reinforcing each other and not acting in isolation. But let me be very clear, spending more wisely will get you only so far. At the end of the day, several European Union nations must also face the challenge of spending more. Ladies and gentlemen, this is an historic endeavor. I hope my remarks have made clear why we need NATO-EU relations and why NATO has every reason to support the SDP. Those who still harbor doubts as to the wisdom of this project should take a look at the big picture. NATO will not lose its central role in European security, nor will the transatlantic security link be weakened by that. On the contrary, when ESDP comes to fruition, Europe and North America will still be working together, we hope, only through more flexible arrangements and with more capability at hand. And after half a century, transatlantic security and European integration are finally coming together, we hope, in a new institutional interface, thus turning a page of history. And this is a good start for managing the new security challenges of the new 21st century. There are bad news, but there are also good news, and I think this is a good news. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. Our final presentation is from Paul Beaver, who we introduced before in his absence. Paul.
Thanks very much indeed. Mr. Chairman, Minister, Deputy Secretary General, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I apologize for doing the mad rush from deepest, darkest Wiltshire. It took me about 40 minutes to get to the outskirts of London and the rest of my life to get through London. But there we go. I have a tremendous luxury here because I'm speaking on behalf of me. I'm not speaking on behalf of any large organization or of any country or the European Union presidency, so I have a luxury that perhaps several people didn't have to quickly read my speech before I gave it. In fact, I've just written it. I have a really personal thing about this. I mean, I'm a person who had great hopes for ESDP. I actually thought that here we actually had at last something that was coming along. I don't share Deputy Secretary General's optimism for, I heard all these words, future will, it's going to happen. I had high hopes that the United Kingdom was actually going to be able to play a leading role and actually do something European for a change. would have been rather good. I actually thought that, you know, perhaps we might see something really quite useful coming out of the SDP. I'm not that hopeful anymore. The minister's absolutely right. I walked in just as he was talking about Iraq, and that is so pivotal to this. I mean, I spent a lot of this morning, one of the reasons I was in Wiltshire, with senior British military officers talking about that thing in Iraq that's not inevitable by any means. I mean, I'm going there next week. I mean, I have absolutely no doubt at all what's going to happen in the next 2 weeks or so. And let me quote you a very senior British military officer who said, as far as I'm concerned, and I knew I was coming here so I could actually pose this question. I said, what about the SDP? After explaining to him what it was, he said, let me be absolutely clear about this. We are closer today being the 51st state than we are of being a useful member of the European Union, because the way in which we intend to operate, the way in which we intend to put our perceived capabilities is going to be in line with the United States, not in line with a bunch of other countries. And I'm quoting him, so forgive me, Europeans on the platform, and I conclude myself as a European, that we are not going to act with a bunch of people who can't decide whether or not we can have 115 millimeter shells, whether or not the airspace will be open to us, whether we can move our aircraft around, and then involved in a very large country in the center of Europe, no guesses there, he might have meant Germany, that in the last 12 months has not managed to sign a single, well actually they have, he's slightly wrong here, military industrial cooperation agreement. You know, we're now 7 years late with A400M, where 62 months later, we are going to have the Meteor Beyond Visual Range air-to-air missile, which is better than anything the Americans have got. We're going to have that now 5 years later, still going to be ahead of the Americans. And we're still going around building legacy systems. He said, I can't believe that my military, my army, the army that I've spent 35 years with is actually going to create, be part of something that doesn't want to use all of this? How can we be with the Europeans? But from the military perspective then, who we're going to fight with is very unlikely to be alongside the Europeans, with the possible exception of two or three sort of small little things, like, for example, the British Army rate the Czech Special Forces. They rate the French Foreign Legion. They don't rate a lot of the Bundeswehr, I have to tell you, and that's the largest European Continental Army. They don't rate a lot of the other forces there. I'll spare some blushes that. From their perspective, the reason that the SDP doesn't even enter the officers' mess conversation after, before, during dinner, whenever, is because it doesn't really make any sense to them. Because they are operating in a world where we need sound intelligence, good security, good planning, good capability. They look at the Europeans and they see the Helsinki goals. 154 capability areas, 100 of which will not be satisfied for at least a decade. How do we deal with that? We have an international summit and we reduce those numbers of capabilities to 20. It's a lot easier that way. 20 doesn't sound so bad. In reality, there are 100 capability areas where the Europeans cannot match the Americans. If we are going to do anything in military terms, whether that's right or wrong, whether there are morals there, it's not my remit here. If we're going to have to be able to fight alongside the superpower, or to operate in the same world as the superpower, or in fact, to have the superpower listen to us as Europeans, we've got to actually have some capability. During Kosovo, 72% of the air missions were flown by the Americans, not because they're gung-ho and they get, you know, bounties for flying missions and shooting down airplanes, whether they're their own or the enemy's. Nothing to do with that at all. They flew 72 missions because there were, at that time, only four NATO nations that could drop precision-guided weapons. 1999, since the bombs first were dropped, 90 years since the first bomb was dropped, and we still actually, in fact, the British even, who are probably the second to the Americans in this, couldn't drop a bomb through a cloud until November of last year, with any accuracy. Now we're up to that speed, and we've seen it over the last few days. But, you know, as far as I am as a European, with somebody who spends spent 20 years of his life looking at these things day on, day in, day out, we cannot compromise on defense. We cannot compromise on security. We need, as Europeans, to have sound defense and security, as to be able to just take our place in the world. This is a dangerous place out there at the moment. This is a little bit like 18th century world. You know, if you don't have the wooden walls of England, you're not actually being taken seriously. It's not because we're imperialist, it's because there are things that need to be done. We can't go it alone. Can we afford to go with Europe in terms of Helsinki goals? Can we afford to go with the Americans? Very difficult questions. If we look at things like the European Rapid Reaction Force from a military perspective, it's neither rapid nor a force. Takes 60 days to deploy. I was in Macedonia, which I have to say, I think is a classic example of how you can do things really well. The Brits went to Macedonia and created brigade headquarters capability in 60 hours. The Germans with the follow-up took 60 days and decided to bring tanks with them. I mean, we didn't even take body armor. It's the differences. If you look around at Europe and you see it, and I'm not saying the Americans are any better, Americans walk around like Imperial Stormtroopers from Star Trek because they probably all saw that at West Point. You see an American general in a helmet and you say, "General, working as a journalist, can you take your helmet off for the interview?" "Son, if I did that, I'd have to ask the President of the United States." You think, you're a bloody two-star general, why can't you do that? But to be serious about this, if we are going to have a serious ESDP, if we are going to be taken seriously by the rest of the world, the UN Security Council, the United States, the North Koreans, the Iraqis, any other organization out there that thinks it might want to disrupt the way in which we tend to live our lives, then we need to have two things. We need to have a common capability. In other words, it doesn't matter if it's a German soldier or a British soldier, he needs to be the same. He needs to have the same motivation, political backing, and skills. Well, that ain't going to happen in my working lifetime. We also need to have funding. We also need to be able to get rid of the legacy programs we've got from the Cold War, and we need to be able to be in a position where we can actually get what we need to have. And we ain't got that at the moment. We've got 100 capabilities. We only have enough helicopters. Do you know, going to Iraq, the British Armed Forces are taking every single helicopter that's flyable. Now, I have some experience with helicopters, having spent wobbly-wop years flying wobbly-wop things. We don't have enough helicopters. We're not the only people who don't have enough helicopters. The minister will tell you that in the Hellenic Armed Forces, they have a large number of helicopters. They don't have enough. They don't have the right ones because of the way the structures were done to fight a war that, thank God, we never had to fight. But he has to fight, I'm sure, these battles every day about getting funding. We do not have enough money. We do not have enough capability. Unless we have those two things, I say from my perspective, we'll never have ESDP. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul, for that lively and rather sobering contribution. Now we have time for questions and comments from the audience. We should have a number of assistants strategically placed to pass microphones so you can speak from anywhere in the auditorium. Please try to keep your questions very short. We'll go to the gentleman here. The gentleman here. Can you wait for the microphone, please, so we can all hear?
It's coming. Oh,
right. Minister, thank you very much to you and your colleagues for very interesting remarks. Just thinking of this in the common sense way, shouldn't we first establish a European unity before we establish a European military goal? Are we putting the cart before the horse when we try and create a European army which lacks, as Mr. Beaver said, funding, motivation, common skills, etc., without having this common European thinking, motivation, political thought, etc.? Aren't we jumping ahead of ourselves? And isn't this creating dangers of a vacuum if the Americans pull out of Europe? Thank you.
Thank you. Can we perhaps group a few questions, yes. Some more? The lady here.
Do you see possibilities of cooperation between the EU and NATO in Mediterranean security to the NATO-Mediterranean dialogue and the Barcelona process? Thank you.
Thank you. Here, the gentleman in the middle.
Could I ask the minister primarily to comment on the European Capability Action Plan process? What were the outcomes recently? And as a second question, it's interesting that not much has been said about civilian capabilities of the ESDP. Could anyone on the panel please comment on any likely developments on that, please? Thank you.
Okay, we have one more in this group. Gentleman at the end of the row, just further back with his arm up.
Got it. Gentlemen, one of your colleagues, right?
My female colleague, Dr. Innes. Please forgive me, the lighting is not quite as what it should be.
It's the
and
short hair.
Old.
Paul Beaver, talked about the military logic taking on a speed of its own now with the British and Americans pushing the no-fly zone, obviously preparing for an attack in Iraq. Given that Blair's logic for pulling the Americans to get multilateral support, in the final event of a war occurring, should the British pull out at the last minute in order to maintain some notion of A, European unity, and B, the priority, the principle of multilateralism? Or should they stay with the Americans? What defends multilateralism the best in the United Nations and in the EU? Britain going in with America or Britain pulling out at the last minute if the Americans refuse to be held back by a second resolution?
Okay, thank you. I'll invite each of our speakers to respond to any of those questions. Mr. Papandreou.
Yes, thank you. Well, I will first try to respond to the question of the cart before the horse. But unfortunately, this is the way Europe proceeds. Always putting the cart before the horse. It won't be the first time. Europeans have a tendency to try to create unity by advancing common efforts. Of course, if they fail, then unity breaks down. And this has been the case in the past 40 years quite a number of times. However, I think that in this particular instance, European defense has not advanced so far faster than European unity itself. I think the present level of common European defense, such as the European rapid or not so rapid reaction force, Mr. Bibo has rightly suggested, corresponds to the present level of European unity. However, matters will change if there are efforts through the European Constitution to advance European defense further by strengthening the force, making it more rapid, assigning it more tasks, or introducing mutual assistance clauses. This will have to correspond to a higher level of political unity by creating political structures such as presidency of the European Union or a common foreign minister or other institutions which will back this stronger European defense. But we're not yet there. But I suggested before that unless the climate or the unity within Europe advances in the next couple of years sufficiently, of course there won't be any scope for advancing further European defense. The two must go together. If they won't go together in the enlarged Union, then I express the fear that some countries in Europe will move alone together and leaving the option of others joining later. But this by itself represents a grave danger because the dynamics of this evolution, both as far as the future of Europe is concerned, as well as the future of American-European relations are concerned, are very highly uncertain because rifts may develop in both sectors, both within Europe and as well as across the Atlantic, that may create more dangers than the problems that will solve. But this, of course, is a bit futurology. We shall have to wait and see. Now, so far as the Mediterranean dimension is concerned, perhaps Mr. Rizzo will say more. All I want to say here is this, that the ESDP is not a closed club. We are opening it up to Mediterranean countries, and in fact, the Greek presidency is organizing various seminars with Arab countries and other Mediterranean countries, not to explain to them that the ESDP is not an aggressive instrument. It is something which is open to all, and if security problems arise in the wider Mediterranean area, of course, the ESDP, together with other Mediterranean countries, can act in unison so as to face security threats affecting this part of the world. The ECAP process. Now, the ECAP process is a highly technical thing. Essentially, what it does boil down to. European strategists have identified a number of areas where Europe must fill in various shortfalls. Helicopters, other transport means, this, that, or the other. Various working groups have been set up with military people, civilian people, and so on, which establish what these shortfalls are and how they can be filled by the potential each country possesses in a reasonable amount of time. This process of identifying problems and suggesting ways to solve the problems, essentially in theory, has finished on March 1st. The next step is the Capabilities Conference, in which ministers will get together in order to respond to the suggestions and the recommendations of these panels, of these working groups. And I do hope that the decisions will be right. Now, the next, of course, question is how soon the decisions will be implemented. And there I come back to Mr. Beaver, who rightly said that there are long implementation delays, there are financial problems, there are this, that, or the other. This is all correct. And one should bear in mind two numbers. America spends on defense more than $350 billion. Well, Europe barely spends $130 billion. And these two numbers correspond to the same gross domestic product basis. In other words, America is doing on defense two and a half times more than Europe. So long as this gap persists, of course, it will be very difficult to fill in the various capabilities shortfalls. So the essence for Europe now is to try to spend more on defense, even gradually, and secondly, to devise new financial methods such as leasing or cooperative arrangements to cover these capabilities. This must be done quickly, and it is one of the objects of the next European Council. Then on civilian capabilities, the European Commission is evolving various processes in which people, civilian people, will assist European military in providing peacekeeping missions and humanitarian assistance. I think the Commission has done a quite good work on this subject. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Witzer.
Well, I think that I'm called only in far as far as the Mediterranean countries are concerned. I would say in this regard that, yes, in fact, NATO has a dialogue, it's called dialogue with the Mediterranean countries. The point is that this country has been living in isolation in terms of security for many years. So what we are doing at the moment is to engage them, for instance, in trying to change their military instrument. They are heavy, big armies, spending a lot of money, rather isolated within their own society. We are trying to help them with our own experiences in order to change that. At the same time, we are engaging them in what we call soft security, which is to say, calling Mediterranean officers to our courses in NATO Defense College, for example, that sort of thing. So that we are doing with some difficulty because these parts are not so easy, not so forthcoming as you might think of that they are. But you know, we are trying hard, and I'm sure that the relationship with the European Union doesn't have any problem with respect.
Thank you. Paul.
I think one of the questions was aimed straight at me about what is British military going to do when A-Day comes up. By the way, there are two days. There's A-Day and G-Day, and guess what? One's Air-Day and the other's Ground-Day. If A-Day comes up, does the British military pull out? Well, obviously that's the decision for the Prime Minister. If I want to put some money on it, I'd be very happy to give you odds of something like 73 million to 1 that we won't pull out, to be honest. It's all to do with the fact that in order to get the force that's going to be there, it's 42,000 British troops there, 72 helicopters, 120 main battle tanks, 150 armored fighting vehicles, and I could bore you with statistics. We've actually taken up all the ships that are currently available. The Americans are currently now asking the Brits for ships in order to move things across the Atlantic because all the shipping that's available has been bought up. I can't see a government climbing down and doing that. Whether in higher the sort of higher strategy of good thinking and politics, whether the United Kingdom should do that. I had always believed, and I don't know how true this is, that the United Kingdom actually has managed to at least delay a fight in to stop the United States operating in quite such a cavalier, or cowboy, I think is the new expression, fashion. I actually believe that the United Kingdom has actually had a very good role to play there. I think also its European colleagues have. I don't think this is just something that the UK can take advantage of. The EU presidency has not been without its influence, I think, and the Hellenic Republic in that regard, I think, has been able in the last few months to be able to do that. If I can just sort of grab a couple of other things. In terms of Mediterranean security, from where I'm sitting in Mediterranean security, the way I look at this, the problem in the Mediterranean is the same as it is in several areas of the world, that there are huge legacy armed forces that are social programs. The reason that Germany has such a large military is because it has 11.4% unemployment. If it didn't have such a large military, that were basically incapable of putting themselves together into a brigade formation. They're there to stop people from being on the streets. It's as simple as that. Until we actually have a common culture in Europe of how we look upon our military. In Britain, we're not very good at soccer. We're not good at rugby. We're not very good at cricket. But we're very good in a scrap. If you want somebody to organise a fight, then you get the Brits to do it for you. You don't get the Germans to do it for you. It's the old thing. What's the definition of hell? British cooks and German policemen. It's about right. Are we going to move with this any further? I really am quite pessimistic about there being any real future in the short term for the European Union and for ESDP as well. I think that the minister's right in terms of going together. They have to go together and they have to move slowly.
Okay, I'm going to squeeze time just for two more questions. We must be out of this theatre by 4 because there's a lecture here. I had stopped the gentleman here. Can I take him? There's a microphone just on his way.
Thank you, sir. It's a question of a more general nature. Do you see any interrelation between the solution of the Cyprus issue and the course of security, peace and security in the Middle East, which is neighboring to Iraq, of course.
Okay. One more question. In the middle here. There's a microphone to your left.
Hi. It's for Mr. Papadoniou. If next week the second resolution by the British and the US is either vetoed or put down,
or rejected.
Rejected, exactly. What's the Greek presidency position on what could happen maybe in the Thessaloniki summit later this year? I mean, could what's the future basically of future stance of the EU on this possibility, even if it's a hypothetical question? And also, what do you think the UN, what will happen with the UN out of this? Thanks.
That's fine, thanks. Mr. Papandreou.
Yes. Well, on the Cyprus issue, the question, as I understand it, is what is the link between the Cyprus issue or the resolution of it with Middle East security as a whole? You mean the Palestinian question, generally speaking? Well, there is a link, although an indirect one, because, as you know, the Cyprus question has a very long history, which is independent from the Arab-Israeli conflict. But definitely, I should think that if there is a solution in the Cyprus question, which will end the tragedy that now exists, of course, this will set a positive precedent for corresponding efforts to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It will be a piece of stability, if you like, in the whole picture of the Middle East, which might influence positively the outcome of the other issue. Although, in the other issue, I think what is more important is to see how the Iraqi crisis evolves. Because if the Iraqi crisis evolves in a way which is conducive to stability in the Middle East, of course, this could create better conditions for resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If, on the other hand, the Iraqi crisis produces tension in the Middle East and new terrorism, which is not unlikely if unilateral actions are taken, or if an eventual war goes wrong and takes long and so on and has many victims, then of course the Israeli-Palestinian issue will take a turn to the worst. So we're living in a very dangerous times, very uncertain times. We can only pray for the best. Now, regarding what we shall do if the United Nations Security Council resolution fails, either through veto or through rejection. Well, first of all, this does not depend on us. We cannot do anything if it fails. It will fail. It will be a matter of fact. Now, the way to proceed afterwards, of course, is to collect the other 14 members of the European Union and put them the question. How do they want to face corresponding questions in the future? We shall very clearly state that Europe has failed in this instance, has failed to act in unison and speak with one voice and exert its influence on the world. And we shall ask them the question how they see the future of the European Union in similar circumstances. Do they still want for Europe to continue failing to project a unified position in the world? Or do they want to make another try, perhaps, by reinforcing the mechanisms for a common foreign and security policy so as to avoid such outcomes, which are very bad for peace and for European unity. It is not something that Greece can respond by itself. But I think Greece will be honest enough to place this question squarely on the hands of those who have created this problem.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you to remain seated for a few minutes whilst the party leaves. Those guests who are here who are Greek journalists, if you could also remain in your seats for the moment, please. But on your behalf, I'd like to thank each of our speakers for the excellent contributions. We've covered a number of major topics and aspects, and we've had some good questions from the audience. So on your behalf, thank you very much indeed.